On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the Russians are coming, the FCC wants less competition, and what happens in OpenStack stays in OpenStack. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 231, recorded March 17, 2017. OpenStack with IBM Cloud Object Storage. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Drobo, a family of safe and expandable yet simple-to-use storage arrays. Drobos are designed to protect your important data forever. Visit drobostore.com and use the code TWIT10 to save 10% off select Drobos. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But it's a big old world, and I can't guide you by myself, which is why I need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, we're getting beautiful weather here in California right now. How are things over across the ocean?
Actually, it's pretty nice. The only bummer is that, you know, things are out of sync for me because Hawaii doesn't do daylight savings. I really hate daylight savings.
Well, I lived on the island, and I do remember that. But just remember, there are those of us who actually have to go through it. So we hate it more. Something we don't hate are our friends over on the right coast of the United States who are represented by Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you? I'm hoping that your health, your hand is okay this week.
Well, the hand continues to make progress, and so I think we're in good shape. It's a lovely day here in the swamp, and, you know, I'll agree with you. I like daylight savings time. The transition to get there, not so much.
Well, gentlemen, we've got a fantastic show planned for the Twiet Ride today. Not only are we going to be covering the news, but we've got a guest from IBM Cloud Object Storage who's going to be telling us a little something-something about OpenStack. But first, as we always do, we have to kick it off with the blips. Now, the FBI says that a group of hackers, including two Russian spies, Dmitry Dukuchayev and Igor Sushkin, hacked Yahoo and stole personal information for about half a billion accounts. Now, that isn't news. We've known that for a while. It's what we've suspected. But yesterday, the FBI released some details as to how it all occurred. And here's what we know. In early 2014, someone associated with the group sent a spear phishing email to an unknown number of Yahoo employees. At least one clicked through on an email which set up a beacon that allowed Alesky, a Latvian hacker hired by the Russians, to install a backdoor on Yahoo's database and account management servers. In December of 2014, Alesky exfiltrated a backup copy of Yahoo's user database, which contained names, phone numbers, password challenge information, password recovery emails, and authentication hashes. Armed with that information, Belan and a fellow hacker by the name of Karim Baratov were directed by the Russians to attack certain accounts that were associated with targeted recovery email addresses. Over the course of several months, they used the password recovery emails and authentication hashes to generate 6,500 nonces that gave the Russians complete access to those accounts. With access to those accounts, the Russians were then able to access a number of Google accounts that had used Yahoo's email as password recovery addresses. This is just the start of the investigation. More to come.
HPE and SUSE are riding together into a cloudy future. Now, depending on how you look at it, either Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, that's HPE, just shed a bunch of cloud assets that it will ultimately lease back, or SUSE just bought itself a big blob of cloud assets along with a really big partner and customer. Here's what happened. Back in September 2016, HPE merged its software business with Micro Focus, which owns SUSE. HPE shareholders own 50.1% of the new company. Now, earlier this week, SUSE finished acquiring cloud assets of HPE's OpenStack Infrastructure as a Service, Cloud Foundry Platform as a Service, and Staccato, which is HPE's Cloud Foundry implementation. According to the blizzard of pet press releases that went out, Seuss will use its new assets to expand its OpenStack program, speeding up the company's entry into Cloud Foundry's growing platform as a service market. In return, HPE will OEM Seuss OpenStack Cloud and the Seuss Cloud Foundry-based PaaS solution as the foundation of Helion OpenStack and Helion Staccato solutions with HPE support and professional services. In a nutshell, this means Seuss will hire HPE's programmers and do the cloud development work, while HPE will sell, deploy, and support the services. It's not an exclusive relationship in either direction, but HPE reconfirmed that Seuss is its preferred open source partner for Linux, OpenStack infrastructure as a service, and Cloud Foundry platform as a service.
Well, New York City is suing Verizon for failing to do a citywide fiber rollout, omitting nearly a million homes. The city and Verizon are arguing as to what passing by every home in New York City actually means, with many building managers complaining that requests for connections have gone unanswered, even while Verizon is claiming they've met all the terms of the 2008 agreement. The complaint states this build-out required Verizon to install fiber optic cable in underground conduit, along above-ground utility poles, or otherwise in front of or behind each residential building, the city's complaint says. New York City says that even Verizon agreed with this interpretation, quoting a Verizon statement in 2008 that said its fiber optic distribution facilities will have to be run past all of the residential locations in the city. I'm guessing this argument is being watched carefully by the rest of the country, with ISPs wondering whether signing such sweeping agreements with cities are even worthwhile.
Newly installed FCC Chairman Ajit Pai is gearing up for the future of the FCC under the new administration. And his first order of business, changing media ownership rules to allow for fewer broadcasters to control more markets. This past Monday, he gave an interview to Variety in which he said, quote, "The core of the rules, which were created in 1975, has shown itself increasingly to not be moored to the current realities of the marketplace. And so our goal is to make sure, in this case and all cases, that regulations match the times," unquote. Though vague about exactly which regulations needed to match the times, the fact that he has already reopened the station group loophole closed by the previous chairman, which allows broadcasters to skirt current media ownership restrictions by purchasing media entities in the names of various operating station groups, seems to indicate that he would approve of large media conglomerations owning more and more content providers. While this seems to be contrary to the promise of candidate Trump, who opposed the AT&T-Time Warner merger precisely because it would, quote, "put too much power in the hands of too few," unquote, President Trump has congratulated Pai for his soft-touch regulations, rewarding him with a nomination for another five-year term. This is seen as a test case for the rollback of net neutrality regulations to see how much opposition he encounters as we move to a less competitive marketplace.
Avaya Networks are going to extreme. Avaya Inc., which filed for bankruptcy protection in January, has revealed it will sell its networks business to Extreme Networks for about $100 million. Extreme Networks said the acquisition of Avaya's networks unit, which includes Ethernet switches, wireless LAN gear, security, and infrastructure management tools, would strengthen its capabilities in the enterprise sector. Extreme, a company best known for its Ethernet switching expertise, says its main focus is on providing software-based networking products and services to IT departments across a range of industry sectors. Should be interesting, because now we get to see whether Avaya's orange gear looks just as good in extreme purple.
So Intel's proposed purchase of Mobileye should be good news for autonomous vehicles. In a statement, Intel CEO Brian Krzanich wrote the following. Intel provides critical foundation technologies for autonomous driving, including plotting the car's path and making real-time driving decisions. Mobileye brings the industry's best automotive-grade computer vision and strong momentum with automakers and suppliers. Together, we can accelerate the future of autonomous driving with improved performance in a cloud-to-car solution at a lower cost for automakers. What makes this significant is the comments seem to indicate that this is a popular move as opposed to a big car manufacturer purchasing Mobileye and alienating the rest of the big players. This neutral platform move may go a long way to moving the autonomous vehicle market forward.
in a move that is almost certainly to become a focal point for Microsoft rage. Microsoft has followed up on their warnings of last year that the Windows 7 and 8.1 boxes with the latest processors from Intel, AMD, and Qualcomm will not be able to scan or download Windows updates. Windows and Microsoft updates will now give those users a code 802-40037, Windows Update Encountered an Unknown Error message, if the Windows 7 or 8 OS is using an Intel, Kaby Lake, AMD Zen, or Ryzen, or Qualcomm 8996 processor. If you are a user who gets this error, Microsoft suggests that you update to Windows 10. If you refuse to do that, there might be a way to use Windows Server Update Services to draw down the updates for distribution to your workstation, or you could muck with your CPU ID to make it identify as an older processor. Either way, Microsoft did give us ample warning, but I'm sure that's not going to stop the rage machine. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to be jumping into the bites, and we need to talk about a little something-something of conservation. But before we do that, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you, are you looking for an affordable, flexible solution for all your storage needs? Because if you do, you're in luck. We've got Drobo, the simple, safe, and expandable solution. They offer a complete line of external storage arrays, which you can order preloaded with drives or add your own. Perhaps you've heard of Drobo, but you're wondering where they fit into the enterprise ecosystem. They provide Tier 2 storage, perfect for backup, bulk storage, and entry-level virtualization. And they're also perfect for work groups that produce images, video, or media. Let me run you through a few of their solutions. They've got the Drobo 1200i. That's a 12-drive monster. A rack-mountable iSCSI storage array for under $5,000. It has 3 gigabits Ethernet ports. It can be provisioned with 2 or 3 SSD drives to accelerate IOPS for transactional operations. And it's ideal for backup storage or as a cost-efficient way to build a nearline archive to important but infrequently accessed data online. If you need something a little smaller, they've got the B810N. It's an 8-drive rack-mountable file-serving appliance with 2 gigabit Ethernet ports that support bonding. It was designed to be the ideal backup target for work groups under 100 people. Drobo has been in the storage game for quite a while, and they've been designing each generation of their products with the features that we want. They actually listened to us from the time that it was in Leo's cottage at the old Twit to now. Drobo invented a technology called Beyond RAID that lets you mix and match drives or instantly expand your capacity by adding a drive or replacing a drive with a larger one without ever having to power down. They've also done things like integrating an internal eUSB device that caches your writes before they can be written to the array. This means that your data is always safe, always protected, even in the case of a sudden power loss at the worst case scenario while you're writing to that array. Now, if you want to see why Drobo can give your enterprise an edge, if you want to see a better way to consider your storage needs, you need to visit drobostore.com to learn more and check out their complete line of products. Drobo has recently lowered prices on almost their entire line, and Twist listeners can save an additional 10% off the purchase of select Drobo models, including the Drobo 1200i, the B810N, and when you use the code TWIT10 at drobostore.com, that's exactly what you're going to get. Again, that's drobostore.com, drobostore.com, and use the code TWIT10. And we thank Drobo for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. Now, there is this idea, it's been hanging around for a while, that if we actually understand how much of a resource we're using, and especially if we're getting charged for the amount of that resource that we're using, that we will just naturally conserve. Well, that claim is both verified and denied by an impromptu study done in Switzerland. A Swedish housing company recently conducted a controlled experiment at its properties. Now, they own 1,800 apartments in 2 areas of Stockholm. Now, each apartment was a part of a block, typically about 80 houses that was connected to a group meter to measure the amount of energy that was being used, electricity, by that group of 80 houses. Now, that was included in the rent. Recently, they switched half of their apartments to individually metered electrical programs so that they would have to pay for the electricity that they used based on the amount of electricity. The other half got their electricity free as part of their rent. Now, the expectation was that the electricity use would drop, especially in those metered apartments, once the tenants realized that they would have to pay for the amount that they were using. And it kind of worked. the top 20% of electricity users reduced their usage so much that it dropped power usage across the properties by 24%. However, the vast majority of tenants didn't change their electricity usage at all. And when we dig down into the information, it becomes even more interesting. When the program was first announced, the block meters dropped about 6%. When the meters were actually installed, the block meters dropped another 12%. And when the first bills actually arrived, the block meters dropped another 6%. Chibert, I'm going to kick this over to you because you actually deal with this. This is exactly your expertise on the islands. You're setting up a smart grid. You are monitoring. You're helping to design the software and the hardware that's going to do this for all the native islanders. What are we to think about this? That some people don't change their energy consumption no matter what. Some people will once they realize they're getting charged. And others just need a nudge to let them know exactly how much they're using. What's your take?
Well, I think a lot of this is you do things and you get hit by unintended consequences. So like, for instance, the U.S. Department of Defense for base housing started doing individual meters on every houses. And what they wanted to do was, okay, let's be fair. You know, dependents normally don't have to pay for their electricity. So they said, okay, we're going to set a baseline for your residents, and we're only going to charge you for anything above and beyond the baseline. So the unintended consequence is all of a sudden everybody started leaving their air conditioners and, you know, appliances on all day to drive up their baseline so that they would never be charged. Well, darn. Several universities have also rolled out meters. So like, for instance, the University of Hawaii in Saunders Hall, we actually have meters on every floor. And the intent was we're going to run a power conservation contest, and there's actually prizes and all that. And wow, the power savings numbers were breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. But once the contest was over and there was no carrot, all this, you know, the power went right back up. It didn't go all the way back up, but so forth. Unintended consequences. People have this habit of, you know, they're going to use what they use. That's, you know, that's always going to happen. Then we're going to have people that say, hey, I need it. I'm going to keep using it. I'm not going to do anything. And then there's going to be folks that I'm using a ton of electricity. Oh, wow. Now I've got to pay for it. Okay, so I'm going to drop it. So, you know, I'm actually thinking, you know, this is a great setup for Padre to do a know-how episode. There's a thing called a kilowatt. You know, it's a little plug. You plug it in and it has LEDs on it and tells you how much power you're using. But there's an Indiegogo, instructables on how to add an Arduino micro or something like that into a kilowatt so that your kilowatt can tweet how much power you're using. Padre, I think you need to do a know-how on using Cayenne with a whole bunch of kilowatts or something like that to measure aggregate power use in, say, a kitchen or a living room or whatever. What do you think? Know-how episode?
I would love to do that. That's a very cool application of something that is actually useful information to aggregate. But it brings up a further question for me, which is, do you think how many people would actually reduce their energy consumption if they knew exactly how much energy they were consuming? Because most of us don't. Either we don't see the bill or it's wrapped up into our rent, or we don't actually have a way to relate how much we're using versus how much other people are using. I'm wondering if gamification works here. Have you seen that, Chibert, on the island experiment?
Yeah.
Do people start reducing their expenditure of energy once they realize how high theirs is versus, say, their neighbor?
Yeah, and actually, one thing that I saw that just tickled me is there's this one corporation where they have a big warehouse and they covered the whole warehouse roof with solar panels. And so they're doing net metering. And the owner of the company actually runs around and tells people, stop using energy, stop using energy. The meter's going to run forward pretty soon instead of backwards. Yeah, kind of gaming the whole system. And then, you know, of course, with PV, this has been a trend. A lot of people are trying to drive their bill to zero or drive their bill positive. They want the power company to pay them money. So, yeah, I think as people know how much they're using, especially in comparison to their neighbor or their peers. Yeah, a lot of this whole game, I've got to do one-upsmanship. That's a pretty big deal, and it's very seems to be effective. It was certainly effective at the University of Hawaii. So maybe we need, you know, maybe a cheaper version of what we're showing on the screen now. But let's use Cayenne so we can compare a whole bunch of them on a dashboard. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm actually down for that. But there is another corollary to this, which is the conservation of energy and the use of energy is, well, we could actually apply it to the conservation of bandwidth, the usage of bandwidth. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you because I'm wondering if you were to do this sort of experiment in the United States, but not with energy, but with the amount of data that you use. I mean, most of us are already pretty data conscious when it comes to our mobile devices, but not so much when it comes to how much we're consuming at home. Do you think it's the same? Is there a direct comparison between gamifying the usage of electricity and gamifying the usage of bandwidth, or is that just completely different?
You know, I tend to think that it's going to be different, although we're going into an era when I think we're going to get an answer to your question, because what we're seeing is a growing number of broadband providers, Charter, Cox, all of the majors that have started putting what amount to caps on the different tiers of their service. You know, if you have a particular tier of service, a particular bandwidth, then you get so much communication, so much data that passes per month before you first get a nasty gram and then start getting additional fees. So I think to this point, pretty much everyone in the U.S. has considered data to be free when it comes to their home broadband. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to usage patterns as they start being dinged for the data usage. It's interesting because the only time I've ever gotten a nasty gram was when I switched over to doing cloud backup. And the first month that I was seeding the backup for an entire hard disk, I got this note from my cable provider suggesting that if this was going to continue, I might want to go to a higher tier of service. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And it gets into all kinds of ramifications, because what happens then to how the people programming the content play with where it sits during the month? Do they want to make sure that pieces that are likely to get more viewership go earlier in the month so that they slide in below all of these caps rather than waiting until late in the month when people might be toning things down to make sure they conserve their bandwidth? We don't know what the implications are going to be, but it's going to be fascinating. It's going to be watched by people in an entirely broad range of the spectrum in terms of job function. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too, actually. And I like that approach. I like that approach of taking a more holistic view of our usage of resources, including power and bandwidth. And by the way, we have many people in the chat room who are pointing out that those are actually very closely related. I mean, when you fire a packet out in the internet or when you receive a stream, it's not magically going from that server to you. It's crossing across multiple data centers, across a lot of different equipment that's all sucking down power. But back to the data example, it's interesting because I ran into the same problem that you did. At one point, my Outlook PSTs were stored in a OneDrive, and every time Outlook touched them, it wanted to re-upload them. Well, that was 15 gigabytes of data every single time I opened up Outlook, and I didn't know that. I had no meter that actually told me that that was happening every time I did that. And then, of course, those files would be downloaded to all the other computers I had OneDrive, and at one point, I had used up a petabyte of data in a week, and I didn't even get a note from my ISP. It was something that I had to pick up on my own equipment, and I'm wondering, and Chibert, I want to throw this back over to you. Can you have that effect if you let people know what their usage patterns are doing? If someone realizes that leaving three Netflix streams on at all times just because he likes background noise will affect the service that his neighbor gets, is that likely to change his or her mind about what they do with that bandwidth?
You know, jury's out. I know a lot of people, especially in high rises, where they really don't care what their effect is on other users. You know, just look at Wi-Fi and how everybody goes and cranks it up to full blast. And even when apartment managers have sent around notes to people saying, you know, just crank it down just a little bit, completely ignored. So I think it really and truly, all that matters is person number one. And if it affects you, something's going to happen. If it's affecting your neighbors, depends on how much you like those neighbors. Well, yeah. Who knows?
It's kind of sad, actually, but it's true. Now, who knows? Maybe at one point we won't need a legislative solution to this. People will just decide to be responsible with the amount of bandwidth that they use, although I'm not really holding my breath. Gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and move on because we normally run into our guest time. I don't want to do this in this episode, especially since we've got a fantastic guest. We are welcoming to the show Petros Katoupis. I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing your name. Please correct me. He is from IBM Cloud Object Storage, and he's here to talk all about the OpenStack. Petros, thank you, and welcome to the show.
Yes, hello, and thank you for having me.
You gotta give me the correct pronunciation of your last name, please.
Katoupis.
It's a lot easier than I'm making it out to be. Well, sir, exactly what is IBM Cloud Object Storage? What does your division do? What do you specialize in?
What do we specialize in? Well, we create a scale-out software-defined object storage framework that deploys on commodity hardware. And it has also been used to power the cloud.
And actually, this is the heart of the topic today, which is this idea of taking something that can be specialized and yet run on commodity hardware. It wasn't too long ago, in fact, probably less than a decade ago, when we first started getting some of these open architecture switches. I'm going to cheat. I'm going to bring back in one of my co-hosts for a segment that we don't normally. Chibert, who was the first one who provided with an open stack available switch?
Oh, man. You would ask me that question.
Actually, I think, you know, it might have been Netgear. I think Netgear and Broadcom both gave us switches at the same time, right?
Could be. I just remember that Wedge and the gang at Interop were actually working with engineering samples of some OpenStack gear at Interop. But truth be told, I can't remember who was the first.
All right. Well, we'll go back to Petros. Petros, when we start talking about OpenStack, exactly what is it? Why should our audience be excited by what OpenStack can do?
Well, I think what makes it exciting is if you understand the history behind it. I've been in the data storage industry for about 15 years now, almost 15 years. And when I first got into data storage, it was a completely different environment. There was no cloud, and our customers also looked a lot different. It was pretty much enterprises. And it was an era of storage area networks, or SANs, and network-attached storage, you know, which we call NAS. And, you know, these enterprises ran, you know, single-vendor shops. If you were an HP shop, you bought your storage from HP. You know, if you were a Dell shop, the same, Dell. EMC, you bought EMC, NetApp, you know, you bought from NetApp. I mean, these were the big vendors at the time. And when I first got into the industry, I started working for it was a lesser known company at the time called Xyratex. They are now part of Seagate. But the only way we were able to market our product was to sell directly to these large vendors who we refer to as OEMs. And then they would just, you know, slap their logo on us. But anyway, you know, things started to change about a decade ago. Exciting new technologies came in, you know, to the scene. You had virtualization, you had flash, software-defined storage was starting to, you know, show up. And these technologies would eventually, you know, lead to the cloud or enable the cloud. But as these new exciting features were being developed, the big, large vendors were not offering them. So these shops, these single-vendor shops, all of a sudden started to step away from that single vendor approach and start to buy outside of those vendors. And now you had this problem where you couldn't manage it from a single management framework. You had too many movable components, and you needed a different level of expertise to manage it all. Now, what OpenStack does and what OpenStack sought out to do from the beginning was it tried to standardize every single, you know, part of all the moving components and then kind of, you know, bring them under a single framework. You know, for instance, you know, you could provision and manage, you know, physical or virtual machines. You could provision and manage, you know, your storage, you know, your block storage, object storage, file storage, authentication and networks. I mean, it sort of brought everything back together to a, you know, single, more manageable framework. And, you know, it's didn't take long for the project to, you know, instantly become popular and take off. And now you have, you know, enterprises and data centers leveraging OpenStack to host public and private clouds. But, you know, the storage vendors that have been, you know, of old and the new ones that have been, you know, showing up into the storage scene noticed this, and they've been starting to conform to the OpenStack API. So now you can grab a storage array from vendor XYZ, and it would be able to plug into OpenStack without problems.
Oh, Petros, there's an interesting backstory to this, because when OpenStack solutions started to be competitive, and by competitive, I don't just mean available, but they were looking attractive in terms of how you would manage your infrastructure, there was the sense that, well, the big vendors aren't going to want this, because Cisco wants you to buy Cisco, and HP wants you to buy HP, and all the different providers want you to stay within their ecosystems. And something like OpenStack, the very promise of being able to run on commodity hardware, seemed to be running counter to the business plans of all the big hitters. What do you think has enabled OpenStack to actually become a viable and supported solution from the big players in the Silicon Valley?
Well, I think we have two key factors here. We have price, cost. When you're not tied to the big vendors and proprietary hardware, and instead you're using off-the-shelf commodity hardware, I mean, obviously that brings the price down significantly. And second of all, I think what also contributed to its success was the fact that it was open source. So with a community built around it, it constantly grows and constantly attracts more people to help it make it better.
Right, right. Okay, so let me understand this. If I were to be an IT guy in our fictional, typical 10,000-seat enterprise network, 10,000-seat network, what would I be using OpenStack for? I'm already using AWS, Amazon Web Services, which, by the way, is a sponsor of the TwitTV network. Where would I use OpenStack? How would I approach the solution to take what I'm already doing and make it more efficient?
That's a good question. You know, OpenStack, like I said, is made up of various components. For instance, you have a component or a module called Nova, which predominantly focuses on the provisioning and the management of virtual or physical machines. You know, spinning up or starting up, shutting down, you know, just deploying new virtual machines under like a Zen hypervisor. I mean, it can all be managed from the management console of OpenStack. And the same thing could be said for, you know, the storage aspect. If you wanted to carve out another logical volume, you know, block-based volume, you can go to the Cinder portion of the of OpenStack, and then provision from a pool of block devices that, you know, that is connected to OpenStack, and then just, you know, carve out a logical volume and then enable it however you wish to choose, however you desire, whether it's to connect it to a virtual machine that's being managed by Nova or you know, something else external in a, you know, in a file share or storage area network, like in a SAN.
All right, let's dive into this because you actually created a video that we have. Could you explain to us exactly what we're seeing?
Yes. The video that I created was just to sort of simplify the installation of a single node private cloud deployment of OpenStack on Ubuntu server on an Ubuntu server virtual machine hosted on Amazon Web Services or AWS. Now, why would someone do this? Well, realistically, I don't think there really is any advantage to installing a private cloud on a public cloud, but Amazon makes it super easy to spin up to provision and spin up a virtual machine with enough CPU cores, RAM, and storage for me to run this virtual machine, which again, OpenStack was designed to do.
And how would I do hybrid deployments with OpenStack? Not just premise and cloud, but multi-cloud. So I want to run OpenStack on AWS and on my premise setup and on Microsoft Azure. Is there some sort of automated process to make that work properly?
That's a good question, and I don't really have that answer. I do apologize.
That's okay. It's one of those things where, it's so difficult to actually answer that because there are so many different frameworks I could drop my infrastructure into. I was just wondering if maybe there was a cheat on OpenStack because every once in a while I do get surprised. What else does our audience need to know about OpenStack before they actually start experimenting? What would you say would be the three biggest mistakes people make as they start to explore?
Well, the biggest mistake is setting up your hardware. Remember, this is software defined. So you need to have a good knowledge of the hardware that you're running on, and not necessarily just that it's the latest and greatest in terms of, it's got this much memory, this many cores, but you need to be careful with the storage controllers and the disk devices that are running on the back end. I mean, make sure your firmware is up to date on your host bus adapters that are, the SAS or serial attached SCSI host bus adapters that are connected to devices, and make sure your drive firmware is up to date. So obviously, number one is just make sure everything's, latest and greatest. Another one is, being able to, that's a tough one. What's another one?
I was thinking about over-promising. I've seen this a lot from the very first OpenStack articles I ever saw, where they were basically saying OpenStack is going to fix every issue you've ever had with infrastructure or dynamic storage allotment. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, it is a fantastic tool, but people need to know the limitations. What are the main limitations?
Some of the limitations also boil down to what you attach to it. For instance, the OpenStack was designed for third parties, to be able to integrate their solutions into that framework, and you may not necessarily get every bell and whistle that the OpenStack API calls for on that from that vendor. So you kind of need to do your due diligence and figure out what that vendor supports when they say, hey, my product is compatible with OpenStack. You need to get a good understanding of to what extent, to what degree, or even which versions of the APIs their product support.
Right. In the video, it's continued to run under our discussion. What is happening now? So you've done a deployment and it's now running?
Yeah. The beauty is, so in this video, I'm using Ubuntu server. And Ubuntu server has made it so easy. I mean, literally, it's running a single command, selecting a few options, and then you just sit back, and an hour later, it's done. Now, I've edited the video where it's down to less than 5 minutes, but I mean the general idea or the point is there where they've done an excellent job. The folks over at Canonical have done an excellent job at literally deploying OpenStack as with as little effort as possible. But you know what? Ubuntu isn't the only one that's, you know, invested so much in OpenStack. In, you know, when we're talking about Linux distributions, Red Hat also, you know, in their enterprise server distributions, go all out with OpenStack support, as does SUSE with their Linux enterprise server distributions. I mean, they've made it easy where anybody can hit the ground running.
You were able to condense that video down into about 5 minutes. How long did that actually take? What was the, you go from the start to the finish, what kind of time frame am I looking at?
So I provisioned on AWS a virtual machine with 4 cores, 16 gigs of RAM, and about 100 gigabytes of storage. And from start to finish, I think it was about 40, 45 minutes.
That's not bad. Okay. No, I can definitely go with that. Let me bring in my co-host here, because I see T-Bert chomping at the bit. T-Bert, of the three of us, you have the most experience with OpenStack. Have you actually deployed it in a production environment yet?
No. Most of the stuff I'm doing is still name brand. But when Kurt and I wrote our first book on cloud computing, one of the predictions that we're kind of pontificating about is one of these days, I don't think we're quite there yet, we should be able to take our task. It might be payroll. It might be, you know, billables or whatevers. And we should be able to go and say, hey, I want to shop it around to all these different cloud vendors, and I'm willing to, you know, have some fudge factor on when I run it. You know, I can, you can sling it around and reschedule it within, say, half a day, but I need it done by such and such a time. I want to be able to shop for it. And I see OpenStack as being one of these stepping stones, because OpenStack, in my mind, is you're desensitizing your applications from the hardware differences, from the hypervisor differences. So in theory, if you're running OpenStack on top of Azure, or OpenStack on top of Hyper-V, or OpenStack on top of VMware, it's still OpenStack. And as long as you're writing to that flavor of OpenStack, you should be able to just drop it in and go. That I see as the promise, the portability, the portability that we lost when we started this hypervisor war.
Right. You say it's close, but it's not there. What's the not there part? I mean, can you really make that concrete? Name out what's the thing that needs to change before you say, okay, I'm willing to actually try this in an actual production environment.
I think a lot of the issues are the same as, say, Android or Linux. Everybody wants their flavor to win. And by making all these changes, you start saying, okay, now I've got a dependency of this or a dependency of that, or I've got to tweak this or I got to tweak that. A lot of people ask me, why do I still run all my production stuff on either VMware or Hyper-V? Why don't I go to KVM or something like that? I go, I want to be able to move my virtual hard drives around. I want to be able to move my containers around. I want to eventually, with OpenStack, I want to be able to move my systems around.
Right, right.
That is, you know, when we finally have standards, when we have the expectation that we can move things easily and expect them to work without having to modify them, that's when we're there.
Petros, right about that, because the flavor war is actually very damaging. It's not the first time that we've seen it. Everyone wants to say that they work with OpenStack. Everyone wants to say that they're inviting OpenStack developers to come and work with their platform. But as T-Bert mentioned, a lot of the bigger players are doing something just a tiny bit different that would keep you in their ecosystem. Does that poison the OpenStack well?
It all boils down to how much they contribute back. That's my opinion. I understand. With regards to portability, the idea of running on top of, you know, Hyper-V or VMware and being able to seamlessly, migrate your instances, your OpenStack instances and whatnot. I mean, that's obviously an attractive quality. In fact, I kind of wanted to bring it back a little bit to the video that I had shared, and that is the way Ubuntu server installs OpenStack, especially in a single node deployment, is that it essentially creates a Linux container to run a single Linux, one Linux container for every instance. So for instance, for example, you have, you know, the a Linux container running the Horizon management UI. And it'll open up a port and start listening, you know, for HTTP requests, you know, for you to, you know, go into your browser and plug in the manager's URL or IP address. I mean, and then it runs another Linux container to monitor your virtual machines and so forth. And I think the portability is getting there, but I mean, there's still much work that needs to be done, but yeah.
But is the portability getting there? I mean, do you see a Cisco, an HP actually contributing enough back to make it possible for me to move an installation directly from AWS over to, say, VMware's new cloud or back to premise on Cisco HP hardware? Is that right around the corner? Because it seems to me like they're not going to let go of that.
No, you know what? You're probably right on that. And what I'm about to share with you is public domain, so it's nothing, you know, company secret. But here at IBM Cloud, we have a provide users or customers with a hybrid cloud solution. Where they are able to do on-premise, private, and public cloud deployments, and then using our what we call Bluemix framework, you know, tie it all together and manage it under a single management interface. And the manager that sort of pulls all of these deployments together is a what we call the IBM Cloud Manager, and it runs on top of OpenStack. Now, I know we do have folks here that sit on the contribute or participate in the committee, the open source committee, and I know we have contributed code back, but with the way we redistribute, I don't know if that's the right term to use, but the way we offer our flavor of OpenStack, I don't believe it'll make it easy for you to transition off of our technology, and I think other vendors are probably in the same boat as we are.
Yeah. And I mean, I get it. That's actually just a business necessity. You don't want to put a huge amount of money into developing for OpenStack only for someone to take your work and deploy it on someone else's system. I understand. But I'm with Cheebert. I think this is one of those cases where the rising tide can lift all boats. I think once we get past that portability issue, we could see OpenStack just absolutely take off. But that means I need to speak to Curtis, because Curtis is our executive man. He understands the mind of CTOs and CEOs and CFOs. Curtis, one of the ways that technology always gets sold in the enterprise is by saying that it's going to reduce our TCO. When I can say it's going to save us money over 10 years, it makes it an easy deployment. But can you say that about OpenStack yet?
No. Okay. And there are a variety of reasons for that, not least of which is that, as Cheebert said, I mean, if anyone amongst us is going to be doing a lot of OpenStack deployment, it would be someone like Cheebert. And there just aren't the vast numbers of OpenStack implementations out there from which people can draw numbers. Now, in addition, there are some things related to OpenStack where we can draw some conclusions. And one of those is the whole notion that because open source software, because open systems can come into our hands without a purchase price, that they are of necessity the lowest total cost of ownership. And we've seen that be disproven on countless occasions. one of the reasons that things like OpenStack are going to have trouble with the TCO issue is because of the complexity. You know, we had a very well-covered episode just a few weeks ago, the whole cloud bleed incident, where what amounted to an issue with a single keystroke in tens of millions of lines of code ended up making some personally identifiable information visible to the world. And this was made visible for millions of people. I had a chat with someone who is one of the leaders in the whole issue of software maturity and software quality. And I asked them, what can we learn from this? What could have been done differently? And the answer was essentially nothing, because it wasn't a mistake. The code was not badly written. None of the code was badly written. It's just that when it was put together in this combination that no engineer behind any single piece of code could have foreseen, there were repercussions. We're going to see that opportunity for problems crop up more and more often as our systems get more and more complex, and the resolution of those problems adds dramatically to the total cost of ownership. Furthermore, if the issues have real-world consequences for users, where you expose personally identifiable information as an example, then dealing with those consequences, in many cases paying fines or compensating the users, can truly dramatically increase the total cost of ownership. So this is one where the best case about TCO right now, when you use something like OpenStack, is that it's an unknown. The worst case is that the overall complexity of this stack is, in its context with all of the other applications that are going to be added to it, are going to end up raising the TCO just as an artifact of the incredible complexity of the systems we're going to build.
Okay, I'm actually down with that. And I kind of like this idea of using TCO but not selling that as a strong point, selling the manageability and selling the flexibility of the solution as a strong point. That actually holds much better promise for me than just saying this is cheaper, we should do it. Petros, we do have some questions in the chat room. Emily the Strange and Tinker Toy Tech, they're wondering what would set aside the IBM approach from, say, what Rackspace is doing. Rackspace says that they offer an open stack solution. What is it that you think you're doing, your group is doing in particular, that gets you excited, that makes you think that this is the solution you want to try to use?
Well, you have to take into account the way people may leverage cloud, you know, from a personal user to an entire company. You know, you have Amazon, for example, with their AWS that, it's a public cloud and they're going to cater to, a certain style of business, as opposed to IBM, where they're pushing the idea of public, private, and on-prem deployments to sort of be managed under a single framework. And you attract a different kind of customer that sees value in keeping some of their data, internal, while the rest they keep, in the public space. But at the same time, going back to, the market or consumer adoption of OpenStack, I think there's a lot more comfort and reassurance when finding a company that stands behind at least their redistributed form of OpenStack. For instance, with IBM and the IBM Cloud Manager, managing all these, private, public, hybrid deployments, we thoroughly test and develop, our implementation of OpenStack to run well in our environment, and we stand by it. So if there's an issue that we didn't, that didn't surface during our internal tests, rest assured that as soon as as soon as, you know, a customer sees it, we're quick to take care of it. And if it's, you know, part of the greater OpenStack code that was affected, then obviously we will push it back to the main line. But yeah, as far as again, it all boils down to usage and what the customer is looking for.
Got it. Okay. So, and I think that's actually pretty good advice, no matter what solution you're looking for, no matter what infrastructure. Chibert, kind of last words here. You made it pretty clear that you do believe in solutions like OpenStack, and I think you've also made it very clear of what you think needs to happen. Where do we go from here? What happens in the next 2 years with OpenStack?
Actually, I think what's going to happen is we're probably going to see a lot more SDN happening, and it's going to be, you know, brand X, brand Y, or brand Z SDN. But I think as we start getting more and more organizations that aren't single vendor, universities are a really good example of that. We would love to see SDN within our college, just with our college, not the university. And we want to be able to move people around. We want the capabilities of SDN. But, oh my God, wouldn't it be great if we could desensitize things and move things around so we can move entire systems between research groups, between buildings, between ships and things like that. So next 2 years, I think we're going to start seeing more and more people experimenting with OpenStack, more and more people eating the learning curve. I think universities in their academic side, the computer science, management information systems, and so forth, are going to start doing a lot more OpenStack. And as these students become professionals and they start going into the enterprise, they're going to be the champions. So we're always going to have that back and forth motion that we don't have the time right now to go and do something really, really experimental. What we need is we need the new blood. We need the new people that are going to go in and really champion this. And, you know, from a management point of view, I'm going to let Curtis do that one.
All right, Curtis, you get the closing on management. What's it for you?
Well, I think that right now OpenStack and the rest of SDN is the kind of technology that has enormous potential. The thing is right now that we're all trying to figure out is just how far down market this enormous potential extends. I think everyone can see why software-defined networking is critical for things like ISPs, for the internet backbone, for major networking providers, and even for the largest of enterprises. What's not obvious is just how small a network can be and still take advantage of the capabilities that that OpenStack provides. Once we start figuring that out, I think we'll have a much bigger handle on just what kind of impact we're going to see and just how much we need to think about all of the implications, because it's one thing to have implications in an organization that can put entire professional teams on solving problems. It's quite another when you're dropping this technology into a group that may have two or three people running the entire IT group. Fortunately, we're a while from that. There's a lot to figure out and a lot to be excited about as we're getting from here to there.
And Petros, you get the last word. Thank you very much for being part of the show. What do you want our audience to walk away with when they think about OpenStack?
Oh, wow. No pressure, right? You know, like I said, what the key to OpenStack's success and its continued success is convergence. It helps bring all those movable parts back together. And, you know, and allows you to be able to provision and manage under a single and very intuitive framework.
All right. Well, very wise words, very wise last words. And gentlemen, thank you very much. And to you, I'm sorry you've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 OpenStack deployments. I do want to thank our guests and our co-hosts. Without them, we wouldn't have a show. Petros, let's start with you. If people wanted to find out more about you, more about IBM Cloud Object Storage, or more about the work that you do with Linux Magazine, where should they go?
Well, actually, not Linux Magazine. It's actually Linux Journal.
Oh, sorry, Linux Journal.
That's okay. And yeah, I do a lot of contributing work with them. But you can follow me on Twitter. It's my handle is PKOUTOUPIS. You can log on to one of my open source projects website for RapidDisk, RAPIDDISK.org. With regards to IBM, it's just IBM.com.
Fantastic. And you know what I want? I want to get a couple of other OpenStack experts, all with their own flavors, and then have a steel cage match. Is that possible? I put my money on you, by the way.
Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. Now we'll welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Chibert, we just scratched the surface of what OpenStack could do. I would love to actually show a real-time deployment in AWS or on our hardware here. Do you think that might be a possibility?
Why not? I'm adding it to my notepad.
Fantastic. Petros, that's Petros, and I'm going to say this right. Kotupis?
Kotupis, yes.
He is with IBM Cloud Object Storage and with Linux Journal. We thank you very much for being here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you.
And of course, I need to thank my co-hosts, without which I would not be able to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. Chibert, let's start with you. It's getting a little warmer. We're changing seasons. What does that mean for the Geek in Paradise?
I'm going to use my air conditioner more.
Is that it? That's the changing of the seasons? It just means you use more power?
Hey, the temperature in Hawaii only varies maybe 10 degrees all year round. Even though I really respect the weather guys in the TV stations, they have the most boring job on earth. temperature in the 80s, chance of showers on the mountains in the evening.
Ugh, okay. You know? All right. Well, with that good weather, where can we find you and your work?
My Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB. And oh, by the way, for those folks joining us in Honolulu or in Hawaii, June 24th, noon to 5 p.m., is the Honolulu Mini Maker Fair at Iolani School. Be there or be square.
Fantastic. Again, that's Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Our other co-host, of course, is Mr. Curtis Franklin, who did not injure himself this week, which is fantastic. Curtis, I know you have another race coming up. Are you actually going to do that?
Oh, absolutely. I've got nearly a month to go before I do the Lightside weekend down at Disney World. That's third weekend in April. If anyone in our Twilight Riot is going to be running that weekend, drop me a line on Twitter. Would love to meet you down there. In the meantime, we're recovering from some genuine cold. We had record cold here in the swamp the last couple of nights. Actually went down into the upper 20s. But fortunately, by the end of the weekend, we should be back up into the 80s for our high and get back to normal weather. And I can get rid of these long sleeves once again. Got lots going on. Look for me over at Light Reading. I've got some interesting interviews coming up. And the big news, still working toward that. We've got a whole new site that I'm going to be heading up over there. And I can't wait to tell everyone about it.
I can't wait either. Curtis, Chibert, thank you very much again for accompanying us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. And of course, thanks to you, to the person who listens, who watches each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show without an audience, and you're the best audience ever. We want to make it easier for you to get the show by going to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find not just all of our episodes, not just the notes that our wonderful editor puts in there so that you can find the stories that we talked about, but also a way to subscribe. That's right. Did you know that you could get Twilight automatically into your device of choice? Not only is it a great way for you to get your enterprise goodness, but it also helps us to support the show and keep it here at Twit TV. Again, go to twit.tv/Twilight and subscribe to the version of choice to automatically download into your device of choice. Also, don't forget that you can follow me, Twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you get to see what I'm doing each week. You get to see what projects I've been working on. You get to see what food I've been eating. Because, yes, I am one of those annoying people who will take a picture of food so I can remember it later. And now I'm really, really hungry. Thank you, Kevin, especially since it's Friday and I'm a priest and I'm fasting. That's just fabulous. You're a good man. But again, Twitter.com/PadreSJ. Also, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo, who keep Twiat on the air. To our engineers like Kara Cole and Alex, who make sure that we're plugged in properly. And yes, to our technical director, Kevin. Kevin, you know this was coming. What is it that you do here at Twiat TV?
I sometimes check my energy usage and compare it to other homes that are less efficient than me. Ha ha ha.
Right, right. And as always, you know that we end every episode with a question, a chance for redemption, Kevin. If you were paying attention to the episode, you should be able to answer this. And that is, how many flavors of OpenStack currently exist?
Five.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was a trick question. The answer is all of them. All of the flavors of OpenStack actually exist. Thanks for playing. We'll give you another chance next week. Until then, I am Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.